the group of students that Jesus had gathered around him as a rabbi. A rabbi in New Testament times composed his class from young men who were essentially grown. And in that culture, they were grown by the age of 15, okay? Our teenagers aren't grown by the age of 15 by any stretch of the imagination. But theirs were, and they only lived to be in their 40s. So you can see why they tried to get an early start on life and the seriousness of life. And so here we have John, whose brother? James, okay. James and John were disciples of Jesus. And James was the older brother. He was the one who was 15 or 16 years old. And John is much younger than that, maybe 11 or 12. And such that their mother went with them. Do you ever wonder about why the mother of James and John was hanging around and asking questions and asking a favor of Jesus for her two sons and that sort of thing? She went with them. In fact, a bunch of women went with the group as they traveled around on their field trips as Jesus taught these youngsters over a period of 3 years or so. And they traveled a lot, didn't they? And so the women provided for them, and some of these women had considerable wealth, and so were able to do that. So John was the little one. He was the young one. And Jesus took a shine to him. That's the conception that a lot of Jewish scholars put to this story, knowing something about rabbis. Okay, so he's close to Jesus. When he ultimately writes his gospel, and it was probably the last one to be written, he gives the interpretations of all of this, doesn't he? He's thinking more in terms of what it all means, much more than the other writers. So he's talking about Jesus as the water of life, the bread of life. Jesus is the good shepherd. Jesus as the father figure, you see, in the stories about the lost son and things of that sort. So Jesus puts meaning to these stories in a way that the other writers don't, because he was the closest to Jesus and he seems to have understood what all of this meant. Well, let me go back to Matthew. Now, what about Matthew? He's not quite as close as John. Why not? John's part of what was called the inner circle. Who were the other two members of the inner circle among the apostles? Who? Peter was one. And James. Peter and James and John. They were taken up on the Mount of Transfiguration. They were with Jesus on some occasions when the others were not. But Matthew wasn't a part of the inner circle. What does Matthew 9:9 say? It has something to do with when he was appointed. What was he doing? He was collecting taxes, wasn't he? And so he's there from the beginning, but he's not quite part of the inner circle. And then how about Mark? Mark's a very interesting one. We talked about Mark. What's Acts 6 and 7? A great number of the priests believed. And you remember we talked about this picture that showed up with the Codex W, and that we have here Luke and Mark. And in Mark's case, I probably should have put this on the screen, but you can see his fingers. And he's the only one that shows you his hand. Do you know why? His nickname was what? Stump Finger. How do you like that for a nickname? Stumpy. I as a stubble field, my dad was called Stub, and as little Stub, I was called Stubby. Okay, that was many years ago. Okay. And nobody's dared do that ever since then. Okay. But But here's stump fingered. Why was his finger short? That middle finger on his right hand only went out to the third knuckle. He evidently had amputated the end of his finger on purpose. Why? So he wouldn't have to serve as a priest, because the priest could not be maimed, you see. Now, so that's conjecture to some extent, but there was a lot of writing in the first and second centuries about the fact that Mark was a priest and that he had done this to himself so that he would be excused. Because it was like being conscripted into the army. When your rank of priests were called up, you had to serve for 6 months or something in the temple. And he starts out with that explanation. Luke starts out with that explanation when he talks about Elizabeth and who was the priest? Zechariah. Okay? So, he's a little more removed and probably was converted after the church was formed, you see, if that's all true. And then what about Luke? Colossians 4:14, what does that say? Well, it says Luke, the beloved physician or doctor. It depends on the translation. But how do we know that about Luke's, was Luke a Gentile or a Jew? Well, in that passage in Colossians 4, if you go back to verse 10, you see some men who were listed, and Paul says, these were the only men among the Jews who were with me, names two or three. And then later on he names Paul. So the implication there is that Paul is not a Jew. What is he then? If you weren't a Jew, you were a Gentile. The Gospel of Luke was written by a Gentile, and that's, you see, he's further away than the others. So it has to do with proximity to Jesus, I think, the perspective that you get. Now, to write to a Gentile world, you see, an account written by a Gentile would mean more to the Gentiles than an account written by the Jews. I mean, you're trying to persuade people. It's not that it's more truthful than the others, but it's just who your source was. And so he investigated all of these things. And we talked about these key words here. An orderly account. And so that you can know the certainty of these matters. And he's writing to a Gentile. And so it's important that it be written by a Gentile. So we have four Gospels written from four different perspectives. And by comparing authors, we find a continuous sequence from the one closest to Jesus, the beloved Apostle John, to Matthew, who was an apostle but not of the inner circle, to Mark, a converted priest, and finally to Luke, a Gentile physician. Luke may not have ever seen Jesus. We don't know. Some years later, Paul probably was the one who converted him, but he came from Antioch, and there was a very active church in Antioch. Luke did, and so it's probable that other people converted him. But then he went with Paul on his missionary journeys and helped Paul. He helped Paul recover from some severe beatings and stonings and things of that sort. Paul really needed him, and kept Paul's health as well as he could. So Luke was probably not an eyewitness. But his gospel contains the accounts of witnesses who related to Luke and interviews what they had seen and heard. So you see, that's important that it be eyewitness accounts, and he's just the reporter in this case. It's as though you're seeing something written in a magazine by somebody who's reporting what the eyewitnesses had said. As a trained physician, Luke was adept at taking notes. You notice that when you go to the doctor. And the doctor says, where does it hurt? And then you tell him, and he scribbles something on his board, doesn't he? Or on his computer in these days. And then he says, and so how long has this been hurting? And what are you eating? And how long have you felt bad? And what's your temperature? And he gets all of this information. Then when he goes home at night, he organizes all of these notes into a paragraph that he puts in your record. So the doctor, even in this time, did this sort of thing. He was adept at making notes. He knew the Greek language very, very well. And he did interviews. He organized his material, creating his gospel account. His classical Greek is the very best in the New Testament. And I think that's important. The Greeks, the Romans, they would be impressed by his writing. They may not have been so impressed by Jewish Greek, which was not their primary language. But here, this is the very best account of the Gospels. As an educated Gentile, his conviction that the life and resurrection of Jesus were factual would be a very persuasive to the Gentile world. And I think that's the way we need to look at these authors. So next time, we're going to look at something about the scribe who did this work with Codex W. And thank you for your attention this morning.